I'm Lee Krivat, host of The Climate Champions. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at KrivatEnergyInnovations.com. My featured guest today is Gunnars Valkers, CEO of Maui Kuia Estate Chocolate. In addition to being CEO, Gunnars is chief dreamer and visionary and heads up the company. He's a full-time Maui resident and retired biotech entrepreneur. Gunnars started his cacao farm with the goal of making great chocolate. As the operation grew, he knew he wanted to tie it into the philanthropy that is so central to life for him and his wife, Joreen. The Climate Champions is sponsored in part by the Gridwise Alliance. Uniting grid modernization experts from across the electricity industry, the Gridwise Alliance promotes grid innovation for a decarbonized economy. To learn more, visit gridwise.org. And if you want to see my food review of Maui Kuia Estate Chocolate, search YouTube for Brooklyn Brothers Food Review Chocolate. And with that, now on to the tasty, chocolatey episode of The Climate Champions. Welcome to The Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and I'm here with Gunnars Valkers, CEO at Maui Kuia Estate Chocolate. Gunnars, welcome to The Climate Champions.
Thank you, Lee. Thanks for offering to let me speak here.
Well, I just loved the chocolate so much when I visited you, and to think you have a microgrid, it kind of made my day.
I'm glad that happened. We are relatively uncommon in having our own power source and power storage. So I guess that makes us fairly unique on Maui.
You are unique anywhere. That you are not attached to the grid is a big deal.
Well, I think it is, actually. I mean, I didn't intend it to be a defining feature of the factory, but it turns out it is, mostly because it actually saved us in the most recent fire in Lahaina. It's not that the fire destroyed anything. The factory was spared, despite the fact that an apartment building across the street burned down. But what it did do was it prevented us from losing power, because the power grid in West Maui was down for a very long time. And in that area where I am, where the factory is, the business park, that area was without power for about 5 weeks. And so with chocolate in the building and 5 weeks of no power and a 95 degree heat outside, eventually the chocolate would have melted completely. So that didn't happen because of our microgrid and our storage capacity and the fact that our microgrid was unaffected by the fire.
I've told a lot of people that story, by the way, since I got back from my vacation.
Well, good. I think it's illustrative. It's certainly not why I built the microgrid. I built it more for standard sustainability. And, you know, it's the right thing to do if you can manage to do it. My original intention was just to have a greener factory, but it turns out it actually saved the factory.
When you talk about having a greener factory, what was your motivating moment going back in time for becoming a climate champion, caring about the environment?
I'm not sure. It's sort of a gradual thing. You know, I would consider myself a liberal Democrat. My general policies on social issues are that, you know, we should be thinking about the future and making a better world for those that come after us. And so it's sort of in alignment with that, right? It's just part of a larger puzzle. But, you know, if you're just thinking about climate change, it's pretty obvious to me, I'm a scientist, that climate change is real. It's very likely the result of our frequent use of carbon dioxide producing fuels and greenhouse gases. I want to try to add to the solution and not to the problem. And, you know, creating a microgrid is, I think, adding to the solution more than anything.
When we met on the tour, you told me that you work 7 days a week. What drives you?
Well, the working 7 days a week is more or less a necessity given all of the existential crises we've had to face. First one being COVID. We opened up the factory just literally weeks before COVID for production. And so we were fully staffed and fully geared up. And then we were shut down. In Hawaii, that shutdown lasted a very long time. from March until roughly the end of October. Visitors weren't really allowed in unless you quarantined for 2 weeks, which meant being locked up in a room for 2 weeks. You can guess how many people did that, especially visitors. Nobody did. And the only people that did were residents trying to get back to the islands. That was number one. That hurt a lot. And it took a long time coming out of that. And now the fire. So the fire, even though it didn't destroy the building or damage it in any way, it has damaged the overall economy on Maui. And it's still there. It's still in sort of not in tatters, but it's certainly not healthy because people feel, I think, that they shouldn't come to Maui. They're being told, you know, don't go to Lahaina, especially. There's obviously burn zones in Lahaina that are not accessible, not permitted to go in. But there are businesses in the periphery like ours that are survivors. In order to continue to survive, we need to start building our businesses back to where they were.
You mentioned that you believe in climate change. When you meet people that don't understand the data or don't believe the data, how do you help to convince them that this is important?
Well, I don't have a book full of facts for them. In general, I think people that are disbelievers. It's a matter of faith to them. You know, a lot of things in the world that are a matter of faith. And I don't criticize anybody's faith, but it's sort of hard to shake them out of that mode if it literally it's a matter of faith. And they refuse to look at facts. Unfortunately, the situation of the world we're in is there's a lot of faith-based decisions, whether it's religious faith or just your faith, that you believe this is true. And it doesn't have to be based on religion, but it's a belief system and it can't be shaken by facts.
So you don't try to convince people.
Climate deniers, it's a waste of my time. I think it's just a waste of my time. I'd rather just live a good example and people will see what I've done and, oh, that's interesting. You know, that you can do that, really? You can be off the grid? And that saved your business? Isn't that remarkable? Well, yes, it did. And so you should learn a lesson from this, right? And so just by seeing things like that in person, those are undeniable facts, right? I mean, they can see it. Telling somebody about the future changes in the average temperature of the world and the pH of the ocean and all these things. I mean, I'm being a scientist. I understand that these things are happening and will continue to happen. But people are not scientists and have their own faith-based beliefs, obviously don't care about that data.
Can you talk more about your chocolate factory and what you do and how that came to be?
Well, I came to Maui in 2007 with the full intention of being retired and never working another day in my life. And now, as I say, I work 7 days a week. So things changed. It wasn't a matter of necessity that I work. It was a matter of choice. I made that choice about 5 years after I came, roughly 2013, when I decided to start growing cacao on a leased land, about 50 acres that I've leased. That was the decision because I just felt like I wanted to do something. I like growing things. And I have 3.5 acres where I live. So I do grow other fruit trees here. I also do grow cacao, but not really for commercial use, just have it around. I got intrigued by cacao because it's truly a tropical tree. It won't grow anywhere on the mainland because it's too cold. Even the warmest parts of the mainland are too cold. I thought that was intriguing. I knew it was what you made chocolate from. That's about all I knew. So being the scientist that I am, I started researching. I got engaged with the University of Hawaii at Manoa. They had an experimental field trial program going on. I joined that program. The graduate student running that program, his name is Dan O'Doherty. He's now my vice president of chocolate operations. So we've been associated with each other, you know, a little more than 10 years. He's still with me and still running the farm and to a large extent contributing to the factory as well. But mostly I'm running the factory.
So I think it's very interesting that you donate all of your profits to charity. Can you talk more about that?
Donation of profits to charity is really the result or the outgrowth of a decision I had to make in roughly 2016. That decision was based upon the fact that after running the farm for about 3 years, it became clear how expensive it was to grow cacao in Hawaii. In fact, I would say it's expensive to grow anything in Hawaii. And that's because of labor costs. My average farm worker makes about $60,000 a year to do manual labor. That's a price that I don't think people on the mainland can comprehend. And minimum wage here, even though there's technically a minimum wage, I think it's established at $15 an hour. Obviously, that's not something anybody can live on. You need to make about $60,000 a year to, you know, even rent a place and live here on Maui. So realizing how expensive it was to grow cacao, I had to make a decision, because the farm project, which originally I thought would establish me as a gentleman farmer, I could sell my beans to chocolate makers, and maybe they would put my name on the label or something like that. That vision sort of evaporated as soon as I realized what the costs were, and had to either shut the farm down and just forget it, which I chose not to do, or to make chocolate, which I did choose to do. But I needed a further motivation to make chocolate, and the motivation is to give back to the community. So when we decided to build the factory, before we even broke ground on the land, we committed to giving 100% of the net profit back to the Maui nonprofit community. So that is our mission statement. It has been that since 2016. Of course, we weren't making any money while we were building the factory, because there's nothing to sell. But then we opened up into COVID, right? So that's that was not easy, throwing a lot of money at the business just to keep it alive. And then we started doing reasonably well in 2022. And then the fire. So that shut us down for a long time, and we're still recovering from that. So we hope to be profitable by the end of summer. We have been giving back to the community through various programs. We engage nonprofits to come bring their supporters, and we, you know, give either tasting presentations, or most recently, what I call the factory experience, which is a walk through the factory with me for 60 minutes. You were on that. Right. So you experience that. And on Sundays, we do that for free. Not for free. We actually charge them, but all the money goes to the nonprofit that signs up for that day. So we've given roughly $100,000 each year since 2020 back to the Maui nonprofit community. And we've done that despite not having the net profit. So it's coming out of my pocket.
As you know, I had a great time on that tour. It was quite an experience. I learned so much. I do live videos and post them on YouTube, usually food, but it was such a great experience. I reviewed the experience and I reviewed the chocolate. I think I gave it a 9.4 or something. It was outstanding. And I've told everybody I know, when they go to Maui, you have got to go on this experience, this tour.
Good. Well, thanks for the promotion. It is a very new thing. We've only been doing it 2 or 3 months now. So it's growing, and it will become an important source of revenue for us. Largely replaces the farm tour, which was suspended up until now since the fire. We are in discussions to restart that, but it hasn't restarted yet. So it's a big source of revenue lost to us, and we need to replace it somehow.
Each day, my wife will show up in my office and say, "It's time for chocolate," and we each have one of the little 0.18 ounce, 5 gram pieces. We join the chocolate club. So we have our monthly allotment, and that's all we allow ourselves each month.
Oh, that's being a little too strict. I eat about 15 to 20 pieces of chocolate like that a day. I call it the chocolate diet. So the diet actually is pretty simple. Between breakfast and dinner, I only eat chocolate and I only drink water. I do not eat lunch, right? So no lunch. And so 15 pieces of those small squares is only 450 calories. Most people eat more than that between breakfast and dinner, right? So it's actually a calorie restrictive diet, even though I'm only eating chocolate.
Well, you need the energy from somewhere since you're skipping lunch, right?
I don't eat all 15 at once. I eat 2 or 3 at a time, gets me through the day. And then I eat a normal breakfast and I eat a normal dinner. So I'm quite used to it. I've been doing it for 4 years now. It's not a problem.
This is a climate discussion. I want to get back to that a little bit. Can you talk about the microgrid? Why did you decide to do it specifically? How is it built? Things like that.
First of all, I had the money to do it because it is a big investment. I think it's about $1.7 million. To build the microgrid. It's 300 kilowatts of solar panels, They cover the parking lot, which is sort of important because Lahaina is really, Lahaina means the merciless sun. That's what it means in Hawaiian. And in the summertime, it's merciless. So you need shade in Lahaina. And the only way to get shade on that lot is to build a roof over the parking structure. If you're going to do that, why wouldn't you put solar panels on that roof? All right. So basically, the roof is solar panels suspended on a steel superstructure that covers the parking lot. And about 900 panels, it generates about 300 kilowatts peak energy development. And it's tied directly to five PowerPack Tesla batteries. For details, each one is 210 kilowatt hours. So it's more than a megawatt hour of power storage. The rooftop solar not only runs the factory during the day, but it charges up the batteries because it's producing excess energy, more than is necessary to run the factory. And then the batteries take over at night and they run the factory all night. So typically we're using about 400 kilowatt hours overnight, and that runs air conditioning, whatever machinery is on. Air conditioning is on 24/7. We don't try to restrict it because the chocolate likes to be cool. And I don't want to be turning it on and off. So it's, you know, constant 70 degrees pretty much throughout the factory. The combination of the batteries and the photovoltaic panels runs the factory day and night. And then, of course, just in case, we have a generator, a diesel generator, but it hardly ever runs. To give you a good example, this winter, I think this is our rainy season. Winter is our rainy season. It's going to be ending in a few weeks. This winter, the generator's only been on 6 hours. It's a 200 kilowatt generator, but it runs only to charge batteries, and it charges them only to a minimal level to keep them, you know, minimally charged. And if necessary, it'll do that again. So it's gone through 6 1-hour cycles over the course of the entire winter. So I consider that, you know, a reflection that Lahaina doesn't ever get very rainy. Because, you know, that only happens when it's rainy and very cloudy. Like, we're cloudy today, but there's enough solar energy that I'm sure the batteries will get fully charged.
Certainly 99% plus renewable energy.
Definitely. If you're off the grid, you have to have another power source. You can't just rely upon batteries and your solar panels, unless you have so many batteries that it can last you a week. But, you know, that's not the case since we're running a lot of energy every day. Our batteries may last about 2 days without being recharged, but that's about it. So we do need the diesel generator just to make sure that if we're in the situation where they need a charge, they can get a charge.
Can you talk about your prior background? How did you get to Maui?
Well, I came to Maui in 2007. I had just retired basically because I co-founded a medical diagnostics company. I have a PhD in biophysics from the University of California, San Diego. I started my career there in a monoclonal antibody company called Hybrotech, which was the first company to commercialize monoclonal antibodies. During that time, I actually invented the first fast pregnancy test. That was 40 years ago. So a long time ago, distant memory, but it was an important development. It sort of enabled me to, I guess, command the attention of the executives. Because of that, they profited significantly. The company was sold to Eli Lilly in 1986. And I decided at that time I was going to leave because the corporate culture changed dramatically and I didn't like it. So I decided I would, you know, recruit some people. So we recruited a couple of other people, some technical people and one business person. And four of us resigned all on the same day with sort of a rudimentary business plan to create another diagnostic company. We went off to do that. Ultimately, that evolved over 19 years. Started with four people in a very small 400 square foot space. And it ended up with 1,200 people in a 400,000 square foot space. So that's over 19 years. But the company developed a very groundbreaking test for congestive heart failure called BNP. And for any medical people out there listening to this, they will understand how valuable that is. It's really changed medical practice around congestive heart failure and is a worldwide standard of care now. So the company became very valuable when that was realized. And in 2007, it was sold. It was called BioSite Incorporated, by the way. In 2007, it was sold for $1.7 billion. So that's how long it took, 19 years from nothing to 1.7 billion. I guess that's not too bad.
That's pretty good. You've talked about the challenges you've had, COVID and the fires in Lahaina. Can you talk about successes that you're proud of?
One of the objectives of the company is not just to give back net profits, but also to make world-class chocolate, right? So I actually thought that was almost a necessity to be able to have the company prosper. Because of the cost of doing business in Maui and the cost of our growing our cacao, I have to make world-class chocolate in order to make a profit. So we've been recognized twice now by an international competition called the Cacao of Excellence. It's run every 2 years. It's a grower competition, and you have to submit beans, and they grade the beans, and then they give the top 50 submissions out of roughly 300. They give the beans to a single chocolate maker that makes chocolate out of all of them. And all of this is done blinded, so the judges and the chocolate maker don't know where the beans are from. They just have a sample code. The chocolate is then redistributed to the judges, who then taste the chocolate, and they combine their scores and give awards. And we've won the gold award for the Asia Pacific region. There's only four regions in the world the way they break it up. And we won the gold award for Asia Pacific twice now in succession. So it establishes us as one of the finest cacao farms in the world after really less than 10 years of operation. So I think that's a great achievement. It does recognize the quality of what we're doing. And it probably is a direct reflection of what Dan O'Doherty has done, because this is his expertise, not mine, the quality of the cacao. So that's one. Other awards are actually chocolate maker awards, and you have to submit chocolate. It has to be unidentifiable, no brands on it or anything like that, because this also is a blind competition. It's called the Good Food Awards. It's run by the Good Food Foundation, and they run it in a variety of food categories, but chocolate is one of the most prominent and the largest number of submissions. And so all the best chocolate makers in the United States enter hoping to win a Good Food Award. Well, we won it in 2022 with our Maui dark chocolate made with our Maui cacao. And this year we won it again for a dark chocolate that we make from Uganda, from a small cooperative of farmers in Uganda. That chocolate was awarded a winner prize in the Good Food Awards, and that will be announced in April. So they've asked me not to publicize it until then. That's why I asked when this would be aired, because as long as it's after the ceremony, I'm fine with it.
Any other successes that you want to talk about?
Bringing a new business model into a community is always difficult. It's not the traditional sort of visitor-oriented business. It is a visitor-oriented business. I need that business because I didn't build the business at the scale that it's at just to create chocolate for the Maui population. It would have been a much smaller store and a much smaller factory. So I do need the visitor business, and that's why these various problems, existential crises, have been affecting me. But I guess I'm, creating jobs, well-paying jobs, for the community. They're getting paid, I would say, more than they would get paid in the general hospitality industry. And that's one of my objectives. I want to pay my people well. I want them to be happy. I want them to have a career path. And I want them to be proud, that we're giving back to the community. That is a significant part of the motivation for why they work here at my company and not elsewhere.
Everybody seemed happy when I was there, and I really admire what you're doing. I just have to say it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's encouraging. And there's a lot of struggles these days with all of the negative issues that I have to face following the wildfire. But it's good to know that people are encouraging me. And every time I do the factory experience, I get more of that. So it's not a burden to me. I can do that five hours a day, every day, as long as the people are enjoying it, because it stimulates me and encourages me to do it. You probably sensed that, during my presentation while I was giving you the factory experience. I think you sensed my passion about the job, and that's what gets me through the day.
One of the things I really loved were the nibs. No sugar, just purely what comes out when you're done with that first step. Right then, I knew it was very special. They were so good.
Well, the nibs are a reflection of the quality of the cacao, and I usually say this during the experience. largely the flavor of the chocolate is, and the quality of the chocolate's baked in when it leaves the farm. When the beans come off the farm, they're already the most important flavor development step, which is fermentation. That happens on the farm. That's already occurred, right? So a chocolate maker can't affect that unless they actually own the farm, which we do. So we actually control the most important flavor development step in making chocolate, and that happens on the farm, and it's called fermentation. I won't go into the details of that, but most chocolate makers, in fact, almost exclusively, chocolate makers do not own farms. They do not have connections to farms where their cacao is grown, and they have no ability to affect that most important step. So they're faced with, you know, using beans that they can buy, and they get what they get. Sometimes it's good, sometimes not so good. Unfortunately for them, they're stuck with that position. We're one of the few companies that actually owns a cacao farm and makes chocolate from it.
Yeah, you get what you grow.
Exactly. A lot of that's driven by the commodity chocolate business, which doesn't care about quality. So consequently, most of the beans out of there in the market are very poor. And they can't make good chocolate because you can't make good chocolate from bad beans. It's not possible. There's no magic in a chocolate factory that converts bad beans into good chocolate.
Getting back to climate, what is your vision over the next 20, 30 years? What do you think the world is going to look like from a climate perspective?
You want me to give my optimistic vision? My optimistic vision is that a renewable energy will eventually turn the tide against what's happening now, which is continual global warming. And whether that happens before some critical point or not, I don't know. I know there are critical points. Generally, people cite this 1.5 degrees Celsius as being like the limit of what we can tolerate. I don't know that that's true or not, but I do know that if you go well beyond that, you know, things like pH changes in the ocean are going to affect, you know, coral growth, and that's going to affect everything. And all of a sudden, you'll be in a downward spiral that you can't come out of, right? The technology can only save you to some extent, but if you've dug a hole for yourself so deep you can't get out, then you're stuck.
Do you have any questions for me?
Why am I of interest to your climate change podcast, right? I mean, it's all about climate change, and I know I have a microgrid, but I sort of have a lot of other things about what we've already spoken about that are not directly related to climate change. So how does that play into, you know, your feature for this podcast?
Not a lot of people know that there are actually microgrids out there that are functioning and are providing great value. People that have heard about it, to a lot of them, it's more of a science experiment. Can we have a microgrid? Yes, they know there are some, but there really aren't that many, especially a microgrid that is supporting a chocolate factory. That is incredibly unique. The air conditioning, the HVAC system is so important to always be on. You survived a five-week outage due to tragic fire in Lahaina. That's an amazing story. So I think people should know, number one, about your chocolate, but also your contribution to the existence of a microgrid, a green microgrid that runs a factory, because it shows what is possible. I think it's very important and interesting.
Well, I guess I don't fully appreciate how uncommon that is. I mean, there are three businesses on Maui that have microgrids that are capable of running their operations. One is a medical marijuana facility, and that's isolated in an area that the power is not easy to get to. So it's sort of obvious choice for them. They do need a lot of power for the grow lights. The second one is Maui Brewing Company, which is a big company. And when they started, they didn't have enough solar to entirely go off the grid. So they do have a connection to the Maui power grid, but then they added solar, and I understand now they can operate off the grid. I don't know whether they've completely divorced themselves from it. They always have that switch. They can flip the switch to get back on the grid if they want to. I don't have that option. You know, there is no wire between me and the Maui power grid. I'm entirely on my own, right? So that's a difference, I think. There's no insurance policy there, nothing backing me up. If it fails, it fails because something happened and I have to fix it. right? I can't call the power company to do it because they don't care.
And that's a big difference between the two microgrids that you just talked about. The Maui Brewing microgrid has a backup, but you don't have a backup. And that is very interesting. But I do love beer. So the next time I'm in Maui, I would love an introduction and maybe I can get them on the podcast.
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
Is there anything else I didn't ask about? Is there anything else that you want to say?
A big part of what I do is to tie the social mission together. The microgrid is a component of that. It doesn't give back directly to the community, green energy, et cetera. It's all good, right? But it doesn't give back directly to the community. But, you know, the whole purpose for the factory and its existence is to give back to the community. You know, so I guess I want to emphasize that, you know, that's why we exist. It's not just to create a microgrid. That was a side sort of side benefit of building the factory was to have the microgrid. But it wasn't the reason. The reason is to give back to the community.
And on that beautiful note, I'm going to wrap this up and I'm going to wrap it up with a wrap. When I first tried your chocolate, I said, wowee, I can't believe you grew the cacao on Maui. What you did to create a monetary egg nest is you invented the first pregnancy test. You wanted to help the world and you've done your part, the BNP test for people's heart. You have winning chocolate and your story is in a great part due to Dan O'Dory. When you're enjoying chocolate, it's good to know it's all about the beans. You get what you grow. You have 300 kilowatts of solar. That's a lot. And that's because Maui is so hot and your solar panels are creating a shaded parking lot. You won many awards for your chocolate. Those contest outcomes were stunners. Talking to you, it's been so much funners. Thank you so much, my good friend, Gunners.
All right. Well, that was good. That was good improv.
What a story. Sells the company he co-founded for $1.7 billion, retires to Maui, starts a cacao farm, builds a factory, powers it with a microgrid, and then COVID hits. And then the tragic Lahaina fire, which somehow spares his factory, but takes out power for 5 weeks, which he navigates through because of his microgrid. And of course, the chocolate is the best I've ever had and one of the best in the world. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at crevatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. When I asked Gunners about how he explains climate change to people that don't understand or believe the facts, he said, "I'd rather just live a good example and let them see what I've done. Seeing things like that in person, those are undeniable facts. They can see it." And although he downplays it, he is a great example of doing good. Through his philanthropy, providing high-paying jobs and treating his employees well, and helping to mitigate climate change.